another episode of Radio Yesterday, brought to you by ChuckChat.com.
Information, please. Wake up, America. Time to turn the tables on the experts. Here's how. Send us questions, one or more, and the right answers. If our editors okay them, they go before a board of authorities, you'll meet them in a minute or two, without the board seeing them in advance. Each question accepted wins you $2, and if it stumps the board, $5 more. Our regular master of ceremonies is back with us again, Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, and the Simon Legree of Information, Please, Mr. Fadiman.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I've just come back from a week in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and while I was there, I spent most of my time answering questions directed at me by my son, Jonathan, who is 6 years old and wants to grow up to be like John Kieran. It's going to be either his life or mine, I guess. Let me tell you, it's a relief to get back here again where I can ask the questions and John Kieran can answer them. That's Mr. Kieran over there in the corner running through the alphabet under his breath. And beside him, I'm glad to see Franklin P. Adams, old friend and crooner, the only man of my acquaintance who has managed to be both at the same time. Mr. Adams, greetings. And let me tell you in confidence, Mr. Adams, that whenever you're stuck tonight, the answer is always Shakespeare. Got that? Shakespeare.
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare. Shakespeare.
Before my time, I'm afraid.
Well, now you try to remember Shakespeare. You don't have anything else to do this evening. We have with us tonight two distinguished guests of honor. The first is Alton Cook, radio editor of the New York World Telegram. And if you want my frank opinion, subjecting Mr. Cook to a half hour of this program is a swell way not to make friends with and influence radio editors. Finally, we're especially proud to have on our program tonight Alice Dewar Miller, whose novels, short stories, and plays have been enjoyed by millions. Perhaps you may not know that Mrs. Miller is also something of an enthusiast on astronomy. Is that right, Mrs. Miller?
Yes, that's right.
And also mathematics. She also claims to know the names of all the vice presidents and repeats them to herself every night while brushing her hair. Ladies and gentlemen, it is to this that she owes the secret of her charm and the vigor of her mind. Ladies and gentlemen, you can do the same. Just send for our free trial package of vice presidents. Now, as I've said before, and still remains true, this is a spontaneous program. Our four mental giants have never seen or heard these questions before. They'll probably demonstrate that in a moment. As for me, I've glanced at the questions long enough, just long enough, to look up the pronunciation of all words over two syllables. I'm going to put the questions to the entire board. Any member who feels confident he knows the answer may raise his hand. The question composed of one or two parts must be answered by a single member. If it's composed of more than two parts, the board may get together on it. But if any part is answered wrongly, we lose $5. I'll cry cash, and the lucky questioner will get $5 smacked out of the register. Now, Mrs. Miller and gentlemen, vacation's over, school started. Are you all ready? Let's go. The first question from Mrs. Helen T. Moore, 25 North Liberty Street, Asheville, North Carolina. Complete the following famous Little Willie jingles. There are three of them, and you've got to get all three. One, Little Willie in the best of sashes fell in the fire and was burnt to ashes. By and by, the room grew chilly, but Mr. Adams...
But no one cared to poke up Willie.
Nice work. Two. This question gets cheerfuller and cheerfuller, or more and more cheerful. Choose one out of two. Little Willie from the mirror licked the mercury all off, thinking in his childish error it would cure the whooping cough. At the funeral, Willie's mother sadly said to Mrs. Brown, "'Twas a Mr. Kieran.
Chilly day for Willie when the mercury went down.
The third one has always been my favorite. Three. Little Willie hung his sister. She was dead before we missed her. Willie's always up to tricks. Ain't he cute, Mr. Adams?
He's only six.
That's right. Perfect score on that one. Mr. Adams.
I think you ought to give the authorship of those.
No, you ought to give the authorship of those.
Those were written by Harry Graham.
Harry Graham?
Yes, sir.
An odd bit of information that we never expected to get free of charge this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Those limericks are written by Harry Graham. I have just learned from Mr. Adams. Thank you, Mr. Adams.
The late Harry Graham.
The late Harry Graham.
They're not limericks.
Mr. Kieran, just about how late was he, do you suppose? Kieran's very accurate on this sort of information.
The next one comes from Mr. Scott Mitchell, 2121 Columbine, Boulder, Colorado. Give 5 slang expressions that mention food. Now, you can get together on this. 5 slang expressions that mention food. And I am the judge as to whether these expressions are slang or not. And ladies and gentlemen, that what you do not hear is thinking. Mr. Adams.
Hen fruit.
Hen fruit, perfectly good, I suppose. 2, Mr. Cook.
Hash house.
Well, you're pretty near to food itself, of course.
Well, that's a restaurant.
Not quite what I meant. Yes, it is a restaurant. Of a sort. I wonder whether we can get a better one than that. Slang expressions. Mrs. Miller.
In the soup.
In the soup is very good indeed. That's 2. Mr. Cook.
The old apple and baseball.
The old apple's perfectly all right. That's 3. Need 2 more. Oh, there are loads of them. Mr. Kieran.
I'll call somebody a hot potato.
Yes, you might. That's 4. Mr. Adams?
Cold turkey.
Yes. Very good. Nuts to you, Mr. Adams, is another one. Now, the next one from Miss Lyle Case, 9306 49th Avenue, Elmhurst, Long Island. Name 4 persons in fiction or in folklore whose hair, plays an important part in their stories. Now, Mrs. Miller and gentlemen, I want you to use your head on that one. 4 persons in fiction or folklore. Mrs. Miller.
I think of 2.
Oh, let's have 2.
Lady Godiva.
Yes, very important indeed. Essential.
And Melisande.
Melisande, very good indeed. Mr. Garrett.
Absalom in the Bible.
Absalom in the Old Testament, excellent. And Mr. Cook.
Samson.
Samson, of course. Let's have another one just for a dividend. Mr. Adams, had you thought of another? No remarks from the audience. The audience is
Herr Hitler.
Bright this evening. Adams, I don't know how long you can keep on doing that sort of thing here. Let's do it one more time. Next time you were telling me you'll be saying the hare and the tortoise, and I won't allow that one. That's correct. Now, Miss A. Warren of Providence, Rhode Island, wants you to identify the following groups in American history. Now, this is serious stuff, ladies and gentlemen. The following groups in American history. There are 5 of them. You have to identify 4 out of the 5. 1. Know-nothings. That's a group. Know-nothings. No personal references. Know-nothings. Mrs. Miller.
Well, they were the anti-Catholic group.
When did they flourish?
I was afraid
history.
You were going to ask me that.
Could you date them at all? Say within a century or two?
Well, I could date them as 19th century, but I wouldn't say...
That's very good. 19th century is extremely accurate. Yes, that's true. They're about the middle of the 19th century, as a matter of fact. A political party who... why were they called Know-Nothings? Could you tell us that?
No, I don't know that.
Don't know that?
Okay.
Can anyone
help
us on that?
I could make it up for you.
I'm sure you could. They were called Know-Nothings because when they were asked for what they stood, they professed secrecy and said they knew nothing. Sound like a possibility for a new party. Excellent platform. 2 carpetbaggers. Carpetbaggers, that's an easy one. Mr. Kieran, let's have that one.
Carpetbaggers were the fellows who rushed down from the north to take advantage of the post-bellum days in the south.
Yes, that's correct. Why were they called carpetbaggers?
Because they carried all they had in the world in a carpet bag.
Neat work. I didn't think you'd know that part of it. 3, mugwumps. Mugwumps. M-U-G-W-U-M-P-S. Mr. Cook?
That's the pre-Civil War political party.
No, I don't think so. I believe they were post-Civil War, though the word was used shortly after the Civil War. Mr. Adams, can you help us on that?
I think it's a man who changes his politics.
His
party politics.
Well, independent Republicans who demanded reforms in 1884 and who supported Cleveland. But they do, they have changed their politics. That's correct. I'd allow that one. Remember the famous definition of... Harold Willis Dodds of Princeton, Mr. Adams, about a mugwump?
No, that escapes me for the moment.
It escapes Mr. Adams, and I've just caught it. President Dodds once said that a mugwump is a man with his mug on one side of the fence and his wump on the other. All right, we'll let mugwump go. And 4, muckrakers. Muckrakers. Oh, that's pretty easy. Volunteers on that, Mr. Adams.
Muckraker comes from Pilgrim's Progress.
All the way from Pilgrim? Must be tired by this time. But how is it
the
used
man
in
with a muck rake.
Yes, but how is it used in connection with our history?
It was used by Theodore Roosevelt. About Lincoln Steffens and other magazine writers who exposed corruption.
Yes, that's correct. Are there any of those muckrakers alive today? I think there are some. Of that old group. I remember some from the old Everybody's magazine. Mr. John T. Flynn, I think, was one of that old group. I'm not sure about that. That's correct on muckrakers. 5 copperheads. That word's come into use a good deal only in the last month or so. Mr. Cook, copperheads.
They were northerners in the Civil War who... it was a term applied to in the Civil War to...
Okay, so far.
To southerners with northern sympathy.
Just the opposite. They were northern Democrats who were disloyal to the North during the Civil War. Is that what you said?
I don't remember now.
Well, too late to go back. Anyway, they did get 4 out of 5, or let's say 4.5. So far, we haven't been able to get these experts down for the count. The next one, from Miss Mildred Milch of 385 Central Park West. Miss Milch wants you to identify and quote the first stanza of a well-known poem, of which this is another stanza. My heartstrings round thee cling, close as thy bark, old friend. Here shall the wild bird sing, and still thy branches bend. I get to know a lot of beautiful poetry at this job. Very lovely, lovely poetry. Give you 2 seconds on that one. My heartstrings round thee cling, close as thy bark, old friend. Here shall the wild bird sing, and still thy branches bend. What's the poem?
Is it just a 2-verse poem?
No, I think it's 4 cylinders. No, it's a rather long poem. Rather long poem.
Have you the name of the author there?
I have the name here. Do you want it?
Would it be Morris?
Yes, that's right.
All right, Woodman, spare that tree.
That's correct. Miss Winifred Breed Rogerson, 47 Lemuel Avenue, Chicopee, Massachusetts, wants to know the following. She wants you to explain how the salutation, hi-ho, is identified with a motion picture, a radio entertainer, a play, and a serialized adventure. First, a motion picture. The phrase, hi-ho. Mr. Cook?
Hi-ho Silver, the Lone Ranger.
That is, of course, a motion picture, but I think that would be much more likely to be called
White.
A serialized adventure. Yes, Snow White. What's the phrase in Snow White in which hi-ho is used?
That's as far as I ever heard it.
That's pretty conservative, Mr. Adams.
It's in the song, hi-ho, from back from work we go, or home from work we go.
Make up your mind.
Yes.
It's off to work we go. What is it, Mr. Cook?
We'll join the CIO is the second line.
In Snow White?
Yes.
Goodness gracious, that thing has changed since my time. A radio entertainer. The phrase hi-ho associated with a radio entertainer, Mr. Cook.
Rudy Valley, hi-ho, everybody.
Yes. A play. This is a tough one. A play. A good play. Mr. Cook.
The farmer takes a wife.
Are you telling me or asking me?
I'm telling you.
Is the word hi-ho used in The Farmer Takes a Wife?
No, but it... hi-ho the derry-o, the farmer takes a wife.
That's pretty far-fetched. It isn't actually used in the play, though it is in the rhyme. Now, in a play by one of Mr. Adams' favorite poets...
Shakespeare.
Attaboy. Attaboy, Mr. Kieran. You'll find the phrase hi-ho used, and I'm not going to give you any more hints. Very well, don't get that one.
I get it.
All right, Mr. Kieran.
Then hi-o the holly, most loving is folly. That's from a song in As You Like It, sung by,
Tito Martini. That's correct. Perfectly correct. And the serialized adventure, of course, was answered already by Mr. Kieran or Mr. Cook, I forget which.
Mr. Cook.
Hi-ho Silva. Mr. Adams, perhaps you can give us a famous poem by Longfellow in which hi-ho is used. Can it? Oh, that's easy. Hi-ho what?
Hi-ho what?
Unrehearsed, I assure you. The next one from Miss Eleanor A. Brown, 51 Marengo Avenue, Hamburg, New York. What 4 ways can a batter reach first base in baseball without hitting the ball? Mrs. Miller, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Well, he can be walked.
Yes, he can be walked.
He can be hit.
He can be hit how?
The ball.
Yes, by a pitched ball, that's 2. 3. Mr. Kieran, want to come to our rescue?
Yes, well, he can get to first base on interference by the catch if he tips his bat.
That's right. And fourth, Mr. Kieran. Mr. Adams.
I think a balk.
A balk?
B-A-L-K.
Don't spell at me, Mr. Adams.
Mr. F.
You think I don't know how to spell balk? I think he's right. Would that be correct, Mr. Kieran?
Well, the interference play comes under the balk rule, but the ordinary rule is that a balk does not advance the batter to first base.
What would the fourth be? Mr. Cook.
The catcher drops a third strike.
Yes, and the batter reaches first base safely. That's quite correct. Those are the four ways. Would you agree to that, Mr. Kieran?
Yes, sir.
Well, they got that all together. Very good. I thought Mr. Kieran was going to hard that one, but he didn't. The next one from Miss Bess Long, 1011 Mifflin Avenue, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Now, you have to know your Alice in Wonderland and your Through the Looking Glass to get this one. It's a tough one. Answer four of the following five questions on Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. One, we'll start with the easiest. About what kind of soup did the Mock Turtle sing? About what kind of soup did the Mock Turtle sing, Mrs. Miller? Do you know that one?
Soup of the evening, beautiful soup.
Quite correct, yes. And very nicely rendered, if I may say so. Two, why did the whiting want the snail to walk a little faster? Mr. Adams.
He's treading on his tail.
Yes, the porpoise right behind me, and he's treading on my tail. That's quite correct. Three, why was it the shoes of the little oysters were so clean and neat? Aren't these pretty questions? Why was it the shoes of the little oysters were so clean and neat? I think I've got them on that one. Miss Vestlong is going to win $5, possibly. Mr. Adams?
They hadn't any feet.
They hadn't any feet. That's quite correct. Four, what subjects were taught in the School of the Sea? What subjects were taught in the School of the Sea, Mrs. Miller?
Breathing and writing and painting and coil.
Yes, and drawing.
And drawing.
Yes, and drawing. Yes, yes, yes. And five, what was the name of the cat that witnessed Alice's trip through the looking glass? Don't jump at conclusions on this one. The name of the cat that witnessed Alice's trip through the looking glass. Mr. Kieran has his head on his hands, thinking very hard. Don't know that one. Well, they did get 4 out of 5. So we don't lose the $5 on that. The name of the cat is Dinah. Now, they all knew it. They all knew it. Now, the next one is a bit of a novelty. I'll ask you to pay close attention. This one is suggested by Mr. H. Coombs of Chicago, Illinois. We're going to play a recording of a group of birds. You're going to identify these birds by their calls. Now, are you all ready on that one? Now, Mr. Adams, do you want to withdraw from this entirely and just
assume.
Just assume. Very well, the first one. How long is this going to keep up?
Is that supposed to be a native bird?
Well, I don't know. I think it may have just gotten in under the recent immigration laws.
No, is that an American bird?
That particular one I don't think is a native bird. Not awfully native. Maybe semi-naturalized.
God, I don't know that one.
Don't know that one. Well, it's a very odd, rare bird. Very rare bird, that.
What, a canary?
Yes, of course.
Well, wait a minute.
That was Mr. Kieran. Just caught on to the canary in time. The second. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a bird, not a member of the...
Sounds to me like a wild geese honking.
It is a goose. I don't know how wild it is. Listen to us a little longer, it gets considerably wilder. Let's have the third. Oh, that's pretty. That's really two birds.
With one stone.
Mr. Adams can contribute nothing in the way of identifying the birds, however. What about that, Mr. Kieran?
How many of these do I have to get?
Well, that's the sound of two birds. You have to get all of the recordings.
Two different birds?
Fairly different, yes. I don't know them very intimately. Mr.
Two lovebirds.
Two lovebirds. No, I don't think that would go. I'd like to admit that. That's a nice thought. Afraid we'll have to let that one go. Mr. Guerin, really don't know that one?
No, sir.
I know it. Have it down here.
What do you got?
Linnets and meadowlarks.
Linnets?
Linnets. What is a linnet?
Do you get linnets around here?
Why, that comes from the prop man. I don't know where we get that. Fourth. Let's have the fourth one. That's one wrong. Mr. Kieran has never heard these birds before. Well, this can't keep up forever.
Boy, these are some birds.
Well, I tell you, these are rather old birds. We've had this record here an awfully long time.
I mean, is that a wild bird or a tame bird?
Just a minute, let me see. Oh, that's as tame as can be.
Well,
yes, Mrs. Miller.
I think that's an owl.
A pigeon.
Owl and pigeon.
I think that's the whippoorwill calling to its mate.
Those are excellent guesses, but it's a western mourning dove. What is a western mourning dove? Anyway, number five. I don't hear a thing.
See it, thank God.
Don't hear a thing. Couldn't be Admiral Byrd. Ah, there we are. Let's have a little more of that. With spinach.
Well, that's not a bird that lives around here, that's all I can say.
Well, I'm not asking for an introduction to your personal friends. I just want to know whether you know or don't know if that is a tufted titmouse.
Oh, well, then, I am wrong. It does live around here, but it's very uncommon east of the Hudson, and I don't see it very
That may be a very unusual titmouse, a neurotic or something.
No, it sounds right now, because I have heard it myself.
You have heard it. We'll have to call that wrong, nevertheless. Now,
I'm very sorry.
The last one. The last one really is a cinch.
Oh, yeah.
Got that, Karen?
Stop. That's the first bird in the Audubon's collection of paintings.
Yes, but I want to know what that is.
Well, it's the bird that you slice on Thanksgiving Day.
A turkey.
That's right.
I belong over there on that table. Turkey is correct. Nevertheless, that's going to cost us $5 in cash. I got only 3 out of 6 on that. Next one from Mr. Robert Granger, 4001 West Broad Street, Richmond, Virginia. We're asked to name 4 of Bob Burns' mythical relatives. This is a question on radio. Name 4 of Bob Burns' mythical relatives. Mr. Cook, would you like to try that one?
Grandpa Snazzy to start with.
Very good. Let's have 3 more.
Well, Island Mary.
I beg pardon?
Island Mary.
Island Mary? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know. Is that right, Mr. Cook?
That's another Bob Burns.
Department. Yes, Robert Burns.
Oh,
Robert Burns. No, I'd only allow that if we were in a pinch, which we're not at the moment, Mr. Adams.
Yes, we are.
Well, maybe you are, Mr. Cook. Let's have 3 more. 3 more mythical relatives. Why, it's a cinch.
Well, I don't know whether they appear regularly. He just, I think, just makes up names as far as...
Well, make up a few. Maybe you can get by that way.
It's his Uncle Snub, his drinking uncle.
Uncle who?
I don't know. Snub, I think.
Snub? I wonder whether I would allow that. I think it's Slug.
Snub. Right.
Snub is correct, sure. That's 2. 2 more.
Well, there is an Uncle Slug, too.
Now, of course, ladies and gentlemen, you think that I'm helping you. I'm not. I won't accept that one. No, sir.
Well,
all I've got is Snazzy and Snub.
He's there just the same. And his Aunt Peaches something, I believe.
Yes, Aunt Peachy Sims. I'll allow that one. That's 3. 1 more. Otherwise, this is going to cost us $5. $5 for which Mr. Robert Granger in Richmond, Virginia is anxiously waiting. 1...
Well, I know the other one, but I got Mike Fright. I think somebody else should answer.
Anybody here not got Mike Fright? Nope. All got Mike Fright. Cash, please. Well, there are several others. There's Uncle Hod, Uncle Fudd, Uncle Skinny Flint, Uncle Bulldozer, and Aunt Boo. Very easy. once you have a white card in front of you with the answers. M. Carnig, 27 West 181st Street, New York City, wants you to name the occupations of the following fictitious persons. Now, there are six of them, and we have to get all of them. One, Crichton. Crichton. Mrs. Miller, did you have the answer on that one?
Crichton was the butler.
Yes, the butler in what story?
In Barry's play, The Admiral.
Yes,
Crichton.
In the play, the Admiral Crichton. Now, the second is Lord Peter Wimsey. And Lord is not satisfactory as his occupation. Lord Peter Wimsey. Mrs. Miller again.
He's a detective.
Detective in whose stories?
In Dorothy Sayers.
That's quite correct. Three, Mr. Chips. Occupation of Mr. Chips. Not a carpenter, Mr. Adams, if you were thinking of that.
Schoolmaster.
Schoolmaster is correct. In what so-called classic? Mr. Kieran.
Well, goodbye, Mr. Chips, but don't ask me who wrote it, because I forget it at the moment.
No, you don't have to answer that, but Mrs. Miller perhaps knows.
James Hilton.
That's correct, Mr. Miller. Thank you very much. For Mr. Peggotty. The occupation of Mr. Peggotty. Mr. Kieran.
Mr. Peggotty is in David Copperfield.
He is indeed. Or was at last meeting.
I forget what kind of job he had. Was he a shipbuilder?
No.
He was a fisherman.
He was a fisherman. Mr. Cook got that one quite correct. Mr. Tutt? Mr. Kieran?
Mr. Tutt's a lawyer, a friend of Mr. Train.
Yes, that's right. And Dodsworth? Mr. Adams?
Motor magnate.
Motor magnate, or automobile manufacturer, if you prefer.
I don't prefer, or I'd have said so.
All right, Adams, I'll get back at you for that. Mr. Adams, do you know the occupation of, here's another one, the Vicar of Wakefield? Thank you, Mr. Kieran, for that one. The next one from Mr. J. Edward Barley, Jr., 3307 Hanover Avenue, Richmond, Virginia. Now, this is a combination of science and sport. At the Olympic Games in Berlin in 1936, Earl Meadows pole vaulted 14 feet, 2 and 15 sixteenths inches. If this meet had been conducted on the moon, a sort of a Buck Rogers game, would Mr. Meadows' same vault have been higher or lower than this? Mr. Cook.
Higher, because there's less gravity in the moon.
Yes, about how much less?
I don't know.
I wonder whether anyone can give us an idea of how much less the moon's gravity is than the gravity of the Earth.
Oh,
Mr. Kieran?
It would be many times less than the Earth.
Well, that's safe enough.
I wouldn't know whether it'd be 15 times or 35 times.
You wouldn't know?
No.
Well, you're giving us an awful lot of information there. Well, it's 1/6 of the Earth's gravity, and so his vault would have been somewhat more than 84 feet.
That's right.
Generous to a vault. Now, the brings us right back to the fact that we have so far lost $10 and that we will have no time for any further questions this evening. That's all for tonight. I want to thank you, Mrs. Miller and gentlemen, and also those who've submitted questions, and $1, $2, or $7, as the case may be. Now, the board for next week. The board for next week will consist of two hard-boiled professionals, Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran, plus Mr. Oscar Levant, composer and pianist. And our special guest of honor will be Mr. Howard Brubaker, author, humorist, and columnist on the New Yorker magazine.